Thanks. Hello, everybody. Nice to be here again. And I will start by just mentioning again how my intention for this hour that we gather is to make it be for you and your questions, whatever it is you'd like to explore or speak about. And you can ask those questions either by raising your hand, taking the mic, typing them into the text box, and or emailing me, which I'll just post. There's my email address once again, and that's a nice way to kind of get the question, make sure you get the question in and get the question out before the gathering even starts. Okay, somebody's right there with a question. That's great. But having said all that, I'm going to start with a question that I received by email, because the person who posted it is here. Okay, I think I'm back. I was saying that someone did email in a question this week. So I'm going to start with that, and then I'll get back to Zach's question as time allows. And in fact, having just glanced at his question, it may even come up in my discussion. We'll see. So I posted the question that I received by email, and I'll read it out loud for those who are just listening. The person emailed me said, "When I am meditating or saying my mantra, I find that it helps me to stay focused and connected to awareness when I feel the subtle vibrations in the chakras, throughout the body or beyond the body. The vibrations in the third eye for me have always been there by default. However, the heart area for me was initially completely absent and now is present but still much weaker than other areas. It seems like practice and avoiding resistance contraction help, but very slowly. Any advice?" So this is a great question, and I'm actually gonna explore it by first speaking from a very general sense, and then I'm gonna come back from there. I will come into speaking more about the heart area and how to work with that, because that is something that I've actually worked with a lot, or explored a lot at least. So the first thing I would say is that this whole journey of awakening, consciousness, spirituality is quite remarkable in its variety, and it's in all the different approaches, all the different paths, all the different experiences, levels, types of experiences that people report and have. And so there are all these different maps, all these different ways of exploring all that. I have a good friend, Jeffrey Martin, who has, he's a neuroscientist, and he's been researching all this stuff for 12 years. And he, in his studies, he found that there are different kinds of awakening, and also with all the different practices and paths that are out there, including the ones mentioned in this question, that the challenging thing is that when it comes to the paths or the practices, is that they tend to, even the best of them, tend to work for roughly about 5% of the people that encounter them, that they have a profound effect, but only are in about 5% of the people that encounter them. I think I mentioned this a couple weeks ago, and that this is a challenging circumstance, a challenging thing to encounter, because if you happen to be one of the 95% that it doesn't have much effect on you, and yet there are other people in the group, in the, you know, coming to the meditations, or you know, in the ashram, or in the practice group, and that there are these people that it's obviously working for profoundly. And maybe you've been there much longer than them and doing it much harder than them in experiences and chakra openings and, you know, samadhis and things like that. And yes, I saw Zach's question. I will get to it. Thanks. So you know, if you're one of the lucky ones who stumble upon something that really works for you, then you know you are blessed in that sense. And if you're one of the ones that something that you've been intrigued by or read about or heard all these great stories about, and you show up and start doing it, and maybe are especially dedicated and inspired and go at it with wholeheartedness, and nothing much seems to happen. There's nothing wrong with you. It's just not a fit. It's like every key is a perfectly good key. They just don't all unlock every lock. And so finding the practice that actually works for you is quite a blessing. And in a sense, if you find something doesn't really have much effect, and by the way, you can often tell this within a week or two of starting any new practice, then it's okay to just acknowledge that and move on. Try something else. In fact, that is probably the most fruitful approach. And by the way, even if you find a technique that really works for you, if it really works for you, it may shift you or change you in a way where it becomes no longer as important or as valuable. If you find a medicine that cures you of your disease, at a certain point you don't need the medicine anymore, and even taking the medicine could be counterproductive. You know, once you've cured your diabetes, you don't want to keep taking insulin. So similarly, and this might or may or may not be something relevant to the person who asked the question, but when you've been doing a practice for a while, it may start to be, there may just be an inner knowing or inner pull, or you may stumble upon another practice that actually fits you better at that point in your practice. It doesn't, you don't have to stick with the same thing for years or decades. If you feel drawn to something, you know, exploring something more, and as in this case, something more to do with the heart area. So that's a very general thing. Another very general thing is that there are so many maps of consciousness, so many different models of what even is supposed to happen when you do spiritual practices. And some of the maps are incredibly elaborate and complex. I was a student of the Diamond Approach for about 10 or 12 years, and their map is probably about the most thorough and wide-ranging map. I mean, there's so many levels and dimensions and subtle aspects of consciousness that they have discriminated, separated out, and explored. And then in contrast, there is Western neo-Advaita, some people call it, the kind of more modern Advaita paths that have grown up that sometimes can be very profoundly simple. I mean, it's sort of a map where there's just one step, really, in the whole map, and it's, you know, to realize who you really are and how everything else is just purely an illusion. And then there's everything in between. There's, as someone mentioned, there's the model from the Vedas that talks about the chakras and the risings, Kundalini risings. There are maps that there's, the Zen even has a map which is expressed in a series of paintings of a person herding cattle. And all of these maps, the thing is, all these maps are true. All these maps they've all mapped out something, and some more than others, but they all are referring to the same truth, the same consciousness, the same mountain, as someone typed in so many paths up the mountain. They're all maps of the same mountain, just from different, looking at it from different sides and in different amounts of detail. And so each map, one map that kind of relates to this question about the heart area is the idea that you can actually have an awakening more in the head center, or more in the heart center, or more in the belly, and that those are all they're not disconnected. They're not separate from each other, but they're different, and they have very different qualities, very different effects. And so the point is that in my experience, and I've worked with and spoken with and explored this with thousands of people now, and in my experience, everyone's path up the mountain, everyone's journey is unique. And ultimately there's no formula. And even the most useful maps, it's good to recognize that they all each person's travel or journey on that map unfolds in its own unique pattern, its own unique sequence, its own unique path. I like to think of it as this: if you drew out this giant map of consciousness with all the different levels and chakras and different kinds of samadhi and everything else all represented on this huge map and all the connections and all that kind of stuff, that then every person on the spiritual path is given a different color magic marker, and they get to just scribble. They just scribble on that map. They just get to connect all those dots up every which way they are inspired to or they are drawn to. And, you know, when they arrive or when they don't arrive, and if they ever arrive and how they arrive, it's always unique. So that all being said, I wanted to say all that at first to give the sense that that the experience described in the question is perfectly fine. That is the way it's happening. She's experiencing vibrations in the chakras that helps her stay focused and connected to awareness. And specifically, she feels those vibrations very strongly in the third eye, but not so much in the heart, though now she's starting to have some experience down there. And so her question is, like, what could she do to have more experience in the heart center? And, you know, that also, by the way, just that impulse, that feeling drawn to it, is a wonderful, natural, normal impulse. And as I said, I've explored this to a fair degree in my own explorations, in my own work with people. And I even wrote a book, an entire book, called "That Is Exactly What Was Happening," because I copied the page. So, anyways, I was saying I pasted a page on my website, and thanks for catching that, Regina. I pasted a page on my website where you can download a book called "Living from the Heart." And it's free. You can actually also download it on Amazon and all the other ebook stores. And on that page, there are seven other books by myself and my wife that are also free. But specifically, the book "Living from the Heart." And here's where it gets interesting, because I gave that overview where I said there are all these different paths, all these different approaches, and even this book about the heart. Even when the focus comes down now to experiencing more of what's possible, more of what's true in the heart area. In the book that I wrote, there are actually three whole sections to the book that were written at different times, but that are three different approaches to the heart. And so, even if someone feels drawn to exploring that book, I recommend that you check them all out. Check out part one. Check out part two. Check out part three. Play with them, explore them, try them out for up to a week or two, and see which kind of approach resonates for you. Which one starts to have the most effect? Not only an effect while you're actually doing, say, the practices or the point, you know, following the pointers in that part of the book, but and start to really be curious about which of those various approaches shift your experience throughout the day. If whatever you're playing with and exploring also seems to have an effect on your state of being, your state of well-being, your sense of peace and happiness throughout the day, then that's an even more powerful kind of sign that it's something that you can go with even more. So very briefly, I will just describe those three approaches to the heart, and then I think I'll just leave then. Sometime I might dive into them more deeply here, especially if someone has a very specific question. But I will say I will briefly describe the three approaches so you get a sense of it, see if it's something, again, that resonates for you. The part one of the book is all about the capacity we have to drop into the heart. It's a very different kind of approach of just, instead of sensing the heart, it's an invitation to sense from the heart and to notice how that changes your experience of just about everything in the world. It turns out to be, again, if it resonates for you, if it's something that is kind of fits for you, it can be remarkably easy to just drop into the heart. And I'm doing it right now, just experiencing the sound of my voice, the room, the view out the window from that kind of center in my body. So that's part one. Now I'm going to jump to part three. Part three is more experiencing the expressions of the heart, the qualities of our being that are expressed through the heart, and specifically love. And part three is really an invitation to love. It's actually the person who was Arn before me, Yelena, was expressing this, the love everything. Not just in a nice kind of Hallmark card abstract sense that, oh yes, I love everything, but to literally and practically give the quality of attention you would give to a new lover, to give that to anything and everything that you encounter. It's actually kind of easiest to start with something neutral, like a pencil or pair of eyeglasses or a lampshade or the carpet or anything at all, that you just allow your attention to flow fully to that object. You can pick an object right now and experiment with this and just give all of your awareness to that particular object. Notice the light. There are different shades and shadow. If you can touch it, reach out and touch it and feel its texture, its weight, its density. If there's any sound associated with it, or if you're touching it creates a sound, then notice that. And just allow it completely to be the way it is. Because this is the quality, these are the qualities of love. A total attention with acceptance, with allowing. And when we do that, we are filled with love. It opens our heart. It allows that quality of our true nature to flow more fully. And then as you get kind of familiar with it, if you play with it a lot, you may discover that you can give that quality of attention to anything, not just objects, but sounds, smells, thoughts, sensations in your body. There's no reason to withhold your love, your attention, because you'll never run out. No matter how much attention you give to something, you can always give more. And so that, again, in the first part of the book, there's this invitation to drop into the heart. In this third part of the book, there's an invitation to experience the flow of love from your heart. We are actually filled with love when we give it in this way. Not so much when we get it. When we get love, it's never enough. When we give love, we're filled to overflowing. And then the second part of the book, which I think may have some even more relevance to a part of the question, where she says, the heart for me was initially completely absent and now is present, but much weaker. And then she goes on to say, it seems like practice and avoiding resistance and contraction help, but very slowly. And this may seem kind of paradoxical, but in part two of the book, it's actually an invitation to just listen to the heart, to just listen to both the expansions and the contractions that happen in the heart area, and to trust them both. That when you experience contraction, especially in the heart, which is the most sensitive to this subtle feeling of contraction and the subtle feeling of expansion, and that when you are experiencing contraction in the heart, that's the right way for your heart to feel. And the reason for that is that expansion and contraction is showing you how true things are. And all there is truth. What is what is. But there are big truths and there are small truths. And some truths are radically small, incredibly small and irrelevant and even kind of uncomfortable when we experience them because they're so contracted. You know, if you listen to someone on television, the news, or a politician, or someone who's very upset, or if your own mind is telling you things that are not very true, you will experience a very strong contraction. And the invitation is to recognize that's the right way for those thoughts, those words, those perspectives to feel, because they aren't very true. And in contrast, when you feel an expansion, when an expansion happens, you can trust that. That's the right way for a big truth, a sense of oneness, a sense of connectedness can give you that expansion, and that's the right way for it to feel. So the other approach is to just trust your heart, notice your heart, track the expansions and contractions that happen naturally and appropriately in everybody's heart. It's not something you have to get better at. Your heart has been perfectly showing you how true things are from the day, you know, the first time you were able to even sense that. And it will continue to do so. So it's really just a question of, it's more like a stance of listening, just noticing what's going on in that center, in that part of your body. And you may notice that there actually are more experiences of expansion than you realized. I always say that, you know, anytime somebody gets contracted, the one thing you can be sure of is that they before that they experienced some kind of expansion. Because you can't contract unless you expand first, and you can't expand unless you contract first. So these two things kind of are two sides of the same coin. Life is made up of big truths and small truths, and we're always moving somewhere, moving, you know, our heart is actually always either expanding or contracting. So those are the three approaches, again, fleshed out much, much more in the book that Living from the Heart, which you can find on that link. So just, hopefully that'll give you some ways to explore the heart area, find out what resonates. And now I'll jump to Zach's question. He typed in, Yoga Hinduism describes a model of consciousness, seven chakras or energy centers that are activated by rising kundalini. And he says, have you found this model to be true or helpful in your experience? The answer is yes, I found this model to be true and helpful in my experience. I'm glad I mentioned all the other models, all the other maps of consciousness, because they all seem to map something that's real. And they often or sometimes seem to contradict each other. I'm not sure if that's really the right word. I think that they complement each other. And so I think that people can have a very rich and full and deep experience of consciousness without necessarily experiencing much of the subtle body system that is is represented by the chakras and the kundalini, and yet other people, that will be the center point of their whole experience. That will be the thing that that is most powerful and profound for them. Personally, I spent some time at a center in Tennessee. It's a wonderful place called PKYC, and they offer what's great about it is that even within this map, most of the people on this call are familiar with the seven chakras. You've at least encountered that model and possibly even had some experiences of them. This group in Tennessee is part of a long lineage tradition from India that has been exploring and studying the subtle body for centuries. And they've identified all these different ways that the kundalini can unfold. I won't turn this into a course in their, they call it video is their science. It's the science of the subtle body. And once again, all of the people, everyone's experience who comes to their center is somewhat unique. So much so that if you go to a retreat at the center, they prescribe individualized practices. So you'll be in a room with several other people everyone's doing practices. Everyone's doing yoga practices, breathing practices. They've also incorporated practices from a lot of other spiritual traditions like Buddhism and Christianity and Native American traditions. And so everyone in the room is doing practices, but everyone in the room is doing different practices. And it's very individually designed based on what is happening in that person's subtle body at that moment, where the blocks are, what has happened. There are even, along with that, the pathway of the seven chakras going up the center of the spine, there are other pathways that the kundalini can travel through. And those experiences are very different, and the approach that they take with each person is unique. So I found their work really helpful, and understanding kundalini really helpful. I also, as I started to say, have found that there isn't always a direct connection between kundalini and the kinds of experiences that other people report in different traditions and different even when I mentioned my friend Jeffrey Martin, who has been studying all this stuff for 12 years. He's interviewed like over 1,200 people who have had an awakening in depth. I mean, these are 8 to 12 hour interviews. He basically says he stays in, he keeps talking to them until they kick him out of their living room. That's how he ran the interviews. And he came and interviewed my wife and myself, and we actually did have to kick him out finally. And so these in-depth interviews, and his take on it at this point is that he thinks they're describing two different things, two different ways that consciousness unfolds. That what he, what he's modeled, and he has his own map, and what he's discovered about awakening doesn't think it necessarily correlates with kundalini. Though I just heard from him today by email, and he's going to the center in Tennessee and going to speak with the woman who runs it. So it should be interesting to see if after that there's more of a cross-fertilization, because it's also fun to see how the maps line up or change. The name of the man who interviews, who's done all these interviews, he's now moved on to working with the research, the results of the research. His name is Jeffrey Martin. He runs a thing called the Finders Course, which is it's kind of based on, he's also the one who said that that only, that each sort of practice or spiritual path seems to only work on a small percentage of the people who stumble upon it. And so he designed a thing called the Finder's Course, which is basically this incredibly intense smorgasbord where he just runs you through one after another after another after another after another spiritual practice for weeks and weeks and weeks, and with the Hope Jeffrey Martin. Week for week for week until hopefully find so that you among the ones that you do during the Finder's Course, there's one that actually fits. It's a very it's a somewhat expensive and involved course to participate in, but it may expose you to something that you hadn't encountered yet. My wife, actually, Gina Lake, offers a much simpler. I don't want to claim that it's a version of the Finder's Course, because that's not what it is, but it's a course that also kind of offers a survey of different approaches, different perspectives on spiritual awakening. She calls it the Radical Happiness Course, and her website is radicalhappiness.com. So, you know, this idea that there are different paths, and you know, Kundalini may be a key central thing for one person and not so much for another. Kundalini may be very important now and not so important later, or vice versa. So I think it's good to have this. You know, it explains, like I said earlier, explains a lot of the endless debates about what is awakening, what is enlightenment, what works, what doesn't work. You know, it makes sense that we have these debates, because everyone's right. Everyone's speaking, most likely speaking from their own experience, and they are they aren't deceiving or just misleading people. They're just sharing what they know, and it naturally kind of leads into what seem like contradictory or confusing descriptions because of all the different possibilities. I always like to point out that consciousness, the mystery, does not even make a snowflake the same way twice. And from that perspective, it makes perfect sense that no two people's awakening is the same. If it doesn't even make a snowflake the same way twice, why would it make something so rich and complex and varied as human, the journey of human consciousness, why would it ever do that the same way twice? I remember someone once saying that they like to read other people's stories of their awakening, because then they would know that it was not going to happen that way for them. It's I think, a wonderful perspective on it, to sort of recognize that whatever anybody else describes is their experience, and that yours will be in some way, maybe subtly, but maybe profoundly, it will be in some way different than the story you just read in a spiritual book. And by the way, if any questions come based on what I'm saying, if you want me to go into more depth or explore in more detail, that's great also. Yeah, someone just typed, even one's own awakening changes from moment to moment. And so all this advice about, you know, trying different practices or, you know, holding all the maps lightly, it applies no matter where you are. One of the things Jeffrey found in his explorations was that everybody who had an awakening thought that their type of awakening was it. They were convinced, because it's such a profound and often, liberating experience, but that they were convinced that that was it. It's like, it makes perfect sense. If that's the experience you're having and it's wonderful and it's liberating, then of course you will argue for its validity. All right, so I have another question here. Someone says, I've been struggling with trying to make an income for the last 20 years. I've never actually been experiencing lack of money. Always supported by my family, the government, some income now and then, I discovered that I have shame and judgments about focusing on other things that don't bring money. I have this belief that I should work to have value, and at the same time resisting and rebelling against it. Freedom seems very important for me, and I want to do whatever I'm inspired without having to force myself. Some people say you receive money when you focus on creating value to other money. When you focus on creating value to other people, value to other money, no, it's a value to other people. I tend to resonate with that. I find it a challenge to start giving more without expecting money. How to find out what is true? That's that last sentence, how to find out what is true. That's the key. And what I would say in response is that everything you wrote is true. All there is truth. There isn't, even your shame and your judgments have truth. That's just all there is. There isn't something else. If you actually look at all the dualities in the world, it turns out that they're actually just different amounts of one thing. What we call light and dark are just different amounts of the one thing that exists, which is light. There is such a thing as photons. There is no such thing as darkons. Same thing with hot and cold. All there is the energy, the movement that we call heat. And there's more or less of it. And so the concept of hot and cold, especially the concept of cold, is useful as a way of describing an experience where there's less heat. But there isn't actually something else. There isn't some coldness that exists and that you can, like I said, you can't. There's no such thing as darkons. You can't buy a flash dark and point it at things and have them disappear. Because there isn't something called darkness. And so everything you wrote in your question about your experiences of money, obviously it's true that you were supported by your family and had some income now and then, the shame and judgments that you experience are normal, natural, and true. And there's a belief that you should work to have value. And then there's also a resistance and a rebelling against that. And those are both true. Freedom is important, that's true. You want to do whatever you're inspired without forcing. And that's a true desire, a true inspiration. Some people say you receive money when you focus on creating value. That's true. So I'm agreeing with everything you said. And then the last question, how to find out, I would change it subtly. I would say, how to find out how true these different perspectives are. And even more specifically, how to find out how true these different perspectives are for you right now. And that's where I spoke a little bit about it earlier. That's where the second part of that book, Living from the Heart. The way you know how true something is for you right now is by the experience in your own heart when you consider it, when you're holding that thought, when you're holding that belief, when you're feeling the shame, when you're experiencing a sense of grace or blessing from the support that you have gotten in this life. How true is it when you are doing something that has value to other people? How true does it feel when you're resisting doing that? How true is it when you focus entirely? How true does it feel? How open, how expanded does your heart feel? Or contracted when you focus entirely on freedom and liberation and spirituality? How true does it feel when you do force yourself? How true does it feel when you allow yourself to just follow your inspiration? And there's no wrong answer. It turns out that life is full of small truths and big truths. And often, experiencing a small truth, exploring it, trying out, forcing yourself to do something that you don't want to do, can be a very enlightening experience. I often say it's equally liberating to find out that something is not very true as it is to experience something that's profoundly true. Because if you are able to really discriminate that, like, say, forcing yourself is an experience of contraction, then you have discovered what's true about it, how true it is. And you also have learned about that particular experience, which may at some point be, even though it's a very small truth, the capacity to force ourselves to do something can be very useful in a narrow context, in a very specific context. I like to use a more graphic metaphor, and I say that a full bladder is a very small truth. That's just obvious from logic. You know, even a very full bladder is probably not much bigger than your fist. And yet it's still true. It still is full. And there's no reason to deny it. There's no reason to pretend it doesn't exist. And in fact, you can respond to that very small truth of a full bladder, specifically by finding the nearest bathroom. And so that's a great metaphor, a great example. You know, this capacity to force yourself to do something is actually a wonderful skill, you could call it. You know, it may not have as wide a use as it is sometimes used. You know, some people are always forcing themselves, and so they tend to stay very contracted relatively. Again, you're always either expanding or contracting somewhat. So even someone who's very, generally very contracted is always still expanding and contracting within that maybe narrow range. And so if you're always having to force yourself, then that would be very limiting. But if you can't ever force yourself to do something, that would also be limiting. It's a funny thing about motivation, is that often motivation comes once we actually are moving, once we actually are acting. So it can be very helpful to force yourself to, you know, a great example is going to the gym or going for a bike ride or a swim or something. You know, if you force yourself to get up off the couch and go for a walk or go for a swim or go to the gym, often then the motivation comes. Once you're out there on the bike and it's a beautiful day, it's like it feels great, you're inspired. You weren't inspired before, you had to force yourself. And if, you know, so within that narrow context, that small truth is still true. And we could dive in similarly to any of the other things. Shame's an interesting one. Some truths are very, very small. And so they have very, very little relevance. Sometimes something can be true, but only true, like, at a very particular point or stage of your human development. And shame is kind of like that. Shame was useful and appropriate when you were very, very small, because you didn't have much else to shape your, you know, to use to shape your behavior, to get along with your parents, with the other people around you. And so you used what worked. Your parents would use judgment and shame. They used what worked to control you, and you learned it. And it was useful at that time. It isn't so useful later in life. And yet sometimes these patterns, you know, become very, relatively habitual. And so we keep using shame and judgments even when they no longer are really the appropriate or relevant way to motivate ourselves or change ourselves. And in fact, at a certain point, changing yourself is seen to be a fairly small truth. You know, efforts to change yourself, fix yourself. Again, that doesn't mean you have to stop. changing yourself or trying to change yourself. It's just if you recognize that that's a small truth, that it's actually, you know, from a much bigger perspective, it's even totally an illusion that you can do that, then you can hold it lightly. You know, you can still, like I said, you can still force yourself to get up off the couch and exercise, but you can hold it lightly. And if if your knee is bothering you that day, or it's pouring rain, you know, maybe, there's a bigger truth that it isn't really, so absolutely necessary, without question, to force yourself to go out and exercise. So it's like a dance. All there is truth, and it's all dancing with itself. It's all dancing with different parts of itself. It's all actually complementary. It all fits somewhere, or it wouldn't exist. Again, the fact that it exists is all the proof you need that it is true. So if a judgment exists, even if it only exists as a thought in your head, it had some relevance, some meaning, some significance sometime. And if it contracts you horribly, if a judgment contracts you a lot, then it's probably not that relevant, not that meaningful, not that significant in this moment. And if a judgment is useful, you know, there's a skillful means. If you decide I'm going to avoid all judgments, and so you don't judge a flat tire of your car as bad, and therefore you get in the car anyways and drive down the freeway with no air in the tire, that's a not very skillful use of the information, the truth contained in that judgment, to deny it, to reject it. But a lot of judgments no longer have any relevance. They maybe did in some very narrow context, in some of the limited ways that we understood life when we were much younger. But they stick around. The capacity to have that narrow judgment is there, whether or not it's relevant. So the important thing is to not just notice what you're experiencing, what you're thinking, what you're feeling, the shame, the judgments, what you believe, but to also always be weighing those, always be holding them lightly and checking how do they actually resonate in my being? Do they allow that sense of opening, softening, relaxation, expansion? Or do they cause a sense of contraction, tightening, holding? And whichever you discover, that's great. That's what you want. That's what you wanted to discover. Because, again, you don't have to get rid of the small truth. It's always relative. Even if your bladder's full, if the house is on fire, suddenly the bladder is back to being a small, irrelevant truth. There's a much more relevant truth, which is get out of the house first and then go find a tree to pee behind. So, but by discriminating, by holding them lightly, holding them not just in your thoughts, but in your heart, in your being, and sensing, how do they fit? How do they apply? How much significance do they have right now? That's what can put them all into perspective. Including, again, I've been speaking a lot about the small truths, but, in this question by Raphael now, he says, freedom seems very important for me. What effect does that have on your heart when you focus on freedom, when you focus on liberation? When that sense of your deepest potential for freedom, or when you experience a greater degree of freedom, sometimes almost a radically different, complete shift into another dimension of freedom. What effect does that have on your heart? You can trust your heart when it shows you that something is profoundly true, transformatively true, because that's also your own discrimination, your own inner wisdom pointing you in the direction of the biggest truth in that moment. So obviously you don't need to, I said you don't need to get rid of the small truths, you don't need to deny or neglect or get rid of the big truths. And when you're aware of a bigger truth, you may respond to that and let the smaller truth be. Let the smaller truth just be there. Raphael said, pointing to freedom creates a big expansion and spaciousness in the heart. See, your heart is working perfectly. It knows. It is inherent in awareness itself. This expansion, this capacity for discrimination is inherent, just like wetness is inherent in water. So it's not something you have to get better at. You are already excellent, perfect at expanding and contracting in response to the different sizes of truth. And for someone who's still trying to get a sense of what that's like, my favorite metaphor is that when something is very true, it feels like it does when you have a roommate and they go away for a month. And there's this sense of like, I can just be myself. There's just this spaciousness, this room to just be. There's a softening, an opening, a relaxation. I always say, if you like it clean, you don't have to clean up after anybody else for a month. And if you don't really care how clean it is, you don't even have to clean up after yourself for a month. Either way, you get to just be yourself relative to when you have a roommate. And then in contrast, when something is a smaller truth, it feels like it would if your roommate came back, only this time they came back with their parents. And their parents moved in with you and your roommate in your little two-bedroom apartment. And it's like the opposite sensation, this like contraction, this sense of like, oh, I can't just be myself. In fact, I may have to just hide in my room for the next month until his parents or her parents leave. And that's just how small truths feel. That's the right way for them to feel. If you put on a sweater that's too small, the right way for it to feel is tight. Doesn't make it a bad sweater. If you like wearing really tight sweaters, or if you're going to be, if you're wearing a lycra suit that you're going to go running in, maybe tight is good, but you want a tight piece of clothing to feel tight. You want something that's bigger, more spacious to feel bigger and more spacious. You can trust your own heart. Raphael typed in, contraction is when the roommates invited their uncles and aunts and cousin and dogs for 1 month. Yeah, I've had contractions like that too. Yeah. So this is, by the way, this, if you really get this sense of how wise your own heart is, how trustworthy it is, you don't need spiritual teachers or spiritual teachings. The true guru, the sat guru, is your own heart. It's always showing you most directly, most immediately, most viscerally, and most clearly how true things are for you. And so that can be your main reference point. And then, you can still enjoy spiritual teachings and spiritual teachers. They are beautiful expressions of often of bigger truths. Maybe bigger truths you hadn't encountered yet. But the final test is in your own heart. The final pointers are in your own heart. The truest guide is your own heart. So, I'm looking at the little clock that shows up on my computer, and I see it's time to let someone else take over this wonderful group. Thanks so much. I look forward to seeing you all in a week. If you want to join again, it's next Wednesday. Bye for now.